placed or traded increase if Indiana sneaks into the top three, because the team may want a top point guard if given the chance. Ryan Dempster looks to build on one of his best outings in what's been a strong season as the Chicago Cubs continue their three-game series against the Houston Astros. Chicago beat Houston 7-2 yesterday. Albert Pujols and the St. Louis Cardinals look for a four-game winning streak tonight when they continue their three-game road series against the San Diego Padres. St. Louis topped San Diego yesterday 8-2. And CeCe Sabathia looks to prevent a fourth consecutive loss for Cleveland while stopping the Chicago White Sox from posting their season-best sixth straight victory tonight. It's the first of a three-game series for the two teams. That's a look at sports. Coming up this afternoon on The World from PRI, the Marine Corps is meeting its goal for new recruits, but that's meant a lot of extra work for Marine recruiters. The challenge of getting young people to sign up, that's during the day's news. Coming up on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on AM 580. As mixed households of meat eaters and vegetarians explore their options, scientists are cooking up what might be an alternative. NPR's Ketzel Levine explores the controversial world of tissue-cultured meat.
I've had easier stories to tell, certainly more bucolic ones. I'd much rather describe cows grazing in meadows than their cells being grown in labs. In fact, even though the idea has been kicking around for a century, it has never seemed a good time to talk about man-made meat. But it's had some famous proponents, including that pragmatic carnivore Winston Churchill, who in 1932 more or less said this.
How strange it is that we have to culture and grow a whole chicken when all I want to eat is the breast meat. The time will come when we'll be able to culture all the chicken breasts that we wish without having to sacrifice a single bird.
I say more or less because that was a British biologist paraphrasing. We'll meet him shortly. Anyway, Churchill was paraphrasing too, likely inspired by the work of Alexis Carrel. At the time of Churchill's comment, Dr. Carrel had been keeping alive a cultured piece of chicken heart tissue for 20 years. It wasn't overflowing the sides of his bathtub or anything. The Nobel Prize-winning scientist kept the tissue fresh and small. But his experiment, which outlived him, fed many an imagination.
My name is Frederick Pohl, and with Cyril Cornbuth, I wrote the book called The Space Merchants.
In that 1952 sci-fi novel, tissue-cultured meat gets a starring, if inglorious, role. It's the starter ingredient for an ever-growing lumpin' food source known affectionately as Chicken Little.
"This is her nest," he said proudly. I looked and gulped. She was a gray-brown, rubbery hemisphere some 15 yards in diameter. Dozens of pipes ran into her pulsating flesh. You could see that she was alive.
Yum. Turns out Frederick Pohl, now almost 90, suspected his novel wouldn't stay science fiction long.
"Actually, when Cyril and I wrote the book, I thought we would see much of it actually happening. Sliced chicken from the delicatessen is probably a lot like the Chicken Little meat would look."
Most carnivores don't fear deli meat, nor do they spend much time at all worrying about where their meat comes from. So pity the malign scientist who, to no one's applause, is knocking himself out this very minute to grow tissue-cultured meat. Yep, it's a happening thing in labs from Norway to North Carolina, and it's being done exactly the same way we already grow patches of human skin. All that takes is a skin cell marinated in a nutrient-rich concoction, and within a few weeks, it's pretty much ready to wear, according to Brian Ford, our former Churchill and author of The Future of Food. We can culture bits of all sorts of distinct tissues.
"But meat is a complex mixture of tissues. Under the microscope, you can see all sorts of gristly bits and fatty bits and muscly bits, and it's this sort of mosaic of different cell types that changes cells into what we know as meat. And that is a problem that nobody has successfully as yet addressed.
But somebody is getting close.
I personally believe that this is inescapable future. That's short answer.
Vladimir Mironov is a biologist at the Medical University of South Carolina and among that handful of scientists culturing meat from animal tissue. Dr. Mironov's long answer involves turning formless, textureless patches of the stuff into mass-produced form, like meat sheets, or what we might call affectionately, schmeat. What stands between Dr. Mironov and schmeat right now is production models, production facilities, venture capital, oh, and consumer demand.
Does people want this? Does market ready? That's the main question. Technology, I think it's doable, and it's, if you have reasonable investment, it can be done. But the question is, you can create product which nobody wants to buy, or it's too expensive to buy. So the right timing is everything.
Okay, so is this the right time? One unlikely nonprofit says yes, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. PETA recently announced a $1 million contest to create commercially viable chicken meat, sacrificing neither chicken nor egg. The deadline is 2012, the contest rules Herculean, and the prize money, paltry. But the thinking is pragmatic. If people must have meat, and factory farming's an animal nightmare, why not find a high-tech alternative? Peter Singer, author of the 1975 treatise Animal Liberation, is all for it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought it would be a good thing. The same way that I think it's good that the abuse of horses for pulling loads has ended. So I think it would be good if the abuse of animals for raising them for meat were to end, because we had a technological solution to that. We had an alternative.
Tissue-cultured meat just doesn't make sense to me. I think it's a very bad idea.
Not a surprising response from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Molecular biologist Margaret Mellon believes that all our food should be grown lightly on the land, using the riches of the earth and the power of the sun, not in a factory.
Picture it. You've got a big compound of buildings with scientists running around tending big vats of cultured cells, making sure that they're all at a constant temperature, that the cells are being kept sterile. I mean, where does that energy come from? That's a lot of fossil fuel.
So here's a recap of opinions on the state of schmeat. It's animal friendly, but bad for the environment. We have the how to, but not the how come. Unleashing unknown technologies is fodder for nightmares. And at least one carnivore thinks it's real meat.
If it looks like muscle, if it smells like muscle, if it tastes like muscle, that's muscle.
Which brings up one last point, the taste of schmeat. Chicken, right? Not so, says a source who has sampled tissue-cultured turkey. It tasted like turkey. Ketzel Levine, NPR News, on the schmeat beat.
Developers are designing a new type of subdivision that is selling well, even in this down market. They say these homes sell better than traditional ones because they give people what they want, the feeling of living in the country while living near the city. Lisa Ann Pinkerton reports the new subdivisions are getting mixed reviews.
There you go. Robbie Dryden is walking her golden retriever, Casey, past a large apple orchard in her neighborhood.
The orchard's great because when the apples start coming off the trees, my kids and I walk down here and we just pick apples.
But Dryden doesn't live in the country. In fact, her subdivision is near a major intersection just south of Philadelphia.
We're off the street, so a lot of people don't really even know that we're back here. I tell people where I live that I live in this area, and they're like, where is that? It's where the orchards are, because all the houses are kind of tucked back. So it's private.
Dryden's neighborhood is known as a conservation subdivision. Its design preserves the orchard and its surrounding meadows forever. A land conservation easement protects 70% of the subdivision from ever being developed. And across the country, a few zoning boards have begun to mandate such preservation in new residential developments. One of these is going up just a few miles east of Dryden's neighborhood. The subdivision is called Weatherstone, and out of 300 acres, 180 of them are preserved as open space in the form of small parks, a working farm, and surrounding fields. Weatherstone is being built by the Hankin Group and Vice President Jim Fuller. He says his company preserves open space on all of its projects, whether it's required or not.
It's certainly more challenging to try to get this kind of project approved and more challenging to build it as well, but it's definitely more rewarding.
Fuller says conservation design builds the same number of homes as a traditional subdivision, but instead of spreading the homes out, conservation lots are smaller and closer together. That makes them cheaper to build compared to traditional homes, and that's because the smaller lot sizes mean shorter roads and sewage lines are needed. On top of that, since the houses are surrounded by open space, builders can charge 10 to 20% more for the homes. The downside, Fuller says, is smaller lot sizes can make local planning boards nervous, especially if they're not familiar with the idea. Building houses closer together is known as higher density, and it's associated with cheaper housing.
Density is something that people are afraid of. You know, they think that if the lots are smaller, then the values are lower. It'll change the values of the adjoining houses. I think it's been proven many times over that the opposite is the case.
As a concept, it's fine, but it doesn't work everywhere. That's the problem with it.
That's Isabel Olcott, who serves on the local and county planning boards in her area of Harding, New Jersey. Her board recently rejected a conservation design that would have preserved 91 acres. She says some townships cherish rural character. Township officials think they can better preserve that by restricting developments to large lots.
If they don't want to live in clusters, it doesn't matter how much open space surrounds them. They will always opt for low-density zoning.
But across the country, open space is being marketed as an amenity, and people will pay for it, even in a bad housing market. Sham Cannon is with the real estate research firm Robert Charles Lesser, and he says demand for these types of developments is outpacing supply 2-to-1.
There's a fundamental need for water, for air, for access to open space, and I think that the traditional development paradigm simply doesn't satisfy those desires anymore.
Cannon and others say today's generation of home buyers don't want a typical suburban neighborhood. Often they want a neighborhood that simulates a rural experience. And they're willing to pay for it. For the Environment Report, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton.
What happens when someone swears on the air? The answer is that it depends. And even that answer could change once the Supreme Court decides the case of the fleeting expletives. Commentator Amy Gatta explains.
There is a word in the English language that some believe is so vulgar, so shocking, and so stinging that it's not fit for tender and even not so tender ears. The word has one syllable and it starts with an F. No, I can't say it. To answer a question posed by someone on the internet, who even determines it's a bad word to begin with? The Federal Communications Commission, my friend, the FCC. A television news anchor in New York City used that particular swear word on the air a few days ago. She said it during a news break when she didn't know she was live. Her mistake caused excited consternation. Some suggested that she be fired. Others came to her defense. The New York Times pointed out that the word has lost its shock and sting because one can hear it if one walks the streets of New York for a mere 4 minutes. I sat in a New York deli with my kids a couple of weekends ago, and a man at the next table used it and its variants in conversation at least 20 times, and that's no exaggeration. He wasn't even angry. Nonetheless, the FCC has decided that the word is profane and potentially indecent, and federal law prohibits any obscene, indecent, or profane language by means of radio communication. That includes broadcast television, but it doesn't include cable. That's why the F word and its kin often make their way into cable programming when you least expect it. And when would you least expect it? The FCC suggests that that would be during the hours of 6 in the morning to 10 at night. That's the time that FCC commissioners have set aside for programming that is neither profane nor indecent, a sort of family hour times 16. In other words, if a station broadcasts certain swear words during that time, the station could face a fine if a listener or a viewer complained. And complain they do. There are groups out there on the prowl for swear words and indecency, with FCC complaint forms at the ready. If you don't believe me, just ask the musician Bono. During the Golden Globe Awards broadcast a few years back, he took the stage to proclaim that his award was absolutely brilliant.